everyone, and welcome to the PE Talks Africa podcast, a podcast by AFCA, the African Private Capital Association, and I will be your host, Persia Castellani. In this episode, we are joined by Samantha Pokoroy, founder and chief executive officer of Sonari Capital, as we delve into the dynamic world of private equity in Africa, focusing on its transformative impact on family-owned businesses across the continent. Join us as we explore Sonari's unique expertise and strategies for scaling family enterprises and the pivotal role they play in Africa's journey to sustainable economic growth, which I'm sure you all know is something that AFCA is very passionate about. So hello, Samantha, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Pasha. It is wonderful to be here.
Could you please introduce yourself and the role that you play at Sonari?
Certainly. So I am the original founder. I started Sonari Capital about 10 years ago. I have been in private equity itself for now 20 years. I guess that makes me gray hair in the room, which is good for investment experience, not good in aging me. But I run Sonari Capital. Today we are a team of 13 professionals in the growth stage private equity focused business. We focus on investments in Africa and businesses that emanate from Africa, primarily from South Africa, but expanding across the continent. We seek out both regional and global exposure and opportunity in our portfolio companies. And my role in the company obviously spans across the entire value chain of the private equity investment process, as well as general management of the fund. I operate at a very interesting intersection of some very interesting fields. And of course, finance sits at the core of that. But we at Sonari, and I can share elements of how it came to be, but we bring in a almost multidisciplinary approach, which includes elements from technology and psychology and our experience with entrepreneurship. And all of these components we bring together to help companies that are entrepreneurial at heart, but seeking to scale and grow and professionalize and achieve their potential. And these are the businesses that we are deeply passionate about. I can also say that I have been now building a company myself, so serving also in an entrepreneurial role. And I'll tell you a secret. It's much harder doing it for yourself than it is telling other people how to do it. So lots of lessons learned over the years and lessons that we like to share in this journey with other entrepreneurial businesses seeking to scale.
Lots of experience there. So when you're talking about the kind of areas of focus, what areas of specialization does Sonari focus on?
Sonari is technically a generalist firm. We operate, as I mentioned, in the growth stage of businesses. So not startup, not late stage mature businesses, but rather businesses that are very well established and at an inflection point. Because of our experience in certain areas, and I'll elaborate on how we got here, our chosen specialization is in founder-run, owner-managed, and family-owned businesses. So very much partnering with these companies to make what is sometimes quite a painful transition from what made you successful in getting to this first level of meaningful scale and now facing the quite overwhelming task of taking your business to the next level, and realizing that what got you to this stage is not necessarily the same set of skills, experience, capabilities to get to the next phase. So we have codified our specialization in what we call our Sonari 3S approach for building businesses that are sustainable, scalable, and saleable. And this is a framework. It's kind of our secret sauce, if you wish, what we like to share with companies when we're looking to invest and partner with them, is that our investment models will look very similar to other private equity firms. But what is really different is the nature of the conversations that we have. And I think that's what we're going to elaborate on today in this discussion, around how we draw on and use this 3S framework to guide our conversations pre-transaction, post-transaction, and all the way through the life of our investment, in making sure that we're aligned with our owner manager or family-owned partners and achieving our shared objectives.
So I know you've touched a few times on integrating technology into the more traditional businesses. Can you give any examples of how you have done this previously?
Sure. Sonari does focus not only on this human enablement side, but very much on this digital enablement side. And that can be either into, you know, cutting edge technology companies. And we have some of those types of investments where it's literally globally scalable technology. Amongst others, we've got a company that today has more than 90% of their revenues outside of the continent. They design, develop, manufacture, and distribute basically the world's smallest LiDAR sensors. And these are used in, amongst other things, drones and Internet of Things, to be able to effectively give eyes to machines, right? So that's a bleeding edge technology product and distributed around the world. But there's other ways of also factoring technology and understanding the threats and opportunities of digital transformation in traditional businesses. And for example, in our schools investment, so we have a bricks and mortar schools group, and they provide accessible education, quality education in a traditional school format. And when we invested, it was already a 20-year-old school, and with lots of good, solid operating experience, and looking to expand and roll out into new regions. And so the question is, well, how do you digitally enable there? And on the one hand, it's about edutech, in the sense of, is there a way to deliver the actual educational services? So for example, a degree of either online schooling or a digital support, or how do you track performance, etc. So it's actually, you can use technology to deliver your service more effectively, more efficiently. So that's one option. But another way of also looking at it, and I think this is important, the schools group is a family-owned business, and the second generation CEO is now running the business. And he's very much interested in preserving the legacy of the business, seeing it go forth and fulfill its potential. But he's also alive to the fact, and one of the things that we look at as a board, that with the accelerating change in the world, AI, and all of the impact that this is having on the future of work, what's really important is that we actually have to consider whether the content that we're teaching our children, so the actual underlying education, is appropriate and fit for the environment that these children are going to go into when they graduate from high school. So it's now about future competencies and how do we incorporate that into the learning that we're teaching. So here again, the digital enablement is not necessarily about making the school more efficient, but actually about understanding the relevance and making our product, being the educational services, more relevant for its customers at the end of the day, the students and their families. So that's one example of how we actually work with very, very traditional business, where the model itself is not necessarily changing, but where we have to evolve our product to be deeply in tune with the future of work and the future of the world.
Thanks, Samantha. So within your 3S approach, one of the areas that Sanari specializes in is family-owned businesses. Could you shed light on Sanari's chosen specialization, in family-owned businesses and the strategic reasoning behind these selections?
Okay, so this probably it justifies a bit of a historical look back at how we landed up evolving and this particular targeted specialization. So first of all, I come from a tradition of family business. I am third generation in a particular cables connectivity industry. My father started his business, and prior to that, my grandfather had started the original business. And in fact, when I was starting Sanari Capital and had no office space, I actually shared an office with my 85-year-old grandfather, which I must say was quite a special experience and great privilege. And what it helped me to do was to contextualize where we saw value unlock. So when I was starting Sanari Capital, I'd just left one of the leading corporate private equity firms on the continent. And my mentor said to me, "What is your investment angle?" And I was like, "That's right. I need an investment angle. We know that financial engineering is all priced into the returns and into the pricing. We also know that operational value add has also actually been incorporated into the pricing. So the ability to get alpha in your investment returns requires now something else." And I'll unpack a little bit more of what that something else is. But at the outset, what I had the opportunity to do was observe back on my experience working at Ethos Private Equity and working then with family business and with owner-managed businesses. And this is small businesses, medium-sized businesses, very large businesses, in some cases businesses that we actually delisted from the stock exchange. And there was this recurring theme around where value got trapped and where companies hit a ceiling on growth and where we had good investments, but where they could have been even better if we had sought to unlock value in these areas that they typically get trapped. And those are areas around key man dependency, depth of management, processes, governance, all of these very fundamental processes that entrepreneurial businesses often don't have in place when they are growing. And in traveling this certain path, and it's not just, founders don't want to let go of control. Sometimes founders are willing to let go of control, but they don't necessarily have the infrastructure around them to be able to do so in a way that truly unlocks value in the organization. And I realized that this 3S methodology would be so powerful for family-owned businesses when, in actual fact, my father asked me to value his company for him. And I had to go back to him with the news that the business wasn't as valuable as he thought it was. And this was quite a shock to my dad. And he asked me why. And I said, "Well, because you've built the business to rely on you entirely. So if you wanted to retire, travel, take very long holidays, and ultimately if you wanted to sell the business, really you could only sell the business for the value of the stock." And that was when I realized that even for family-owned businesses like my own family's, the importance of building equity value in the company and not in the individuals, not in the individual founder or in the individual family members, creates an option value to be able to realize wealth or to make choices at various points in time, and not to effectively have built yourself a prison which you are now required to stay in order to sustain the wealth creation for your family, for the founders, etc., into the future. And so it was really understanding that this need existed that informed the investment strategy of Sinari. What we do is we focus in on these areas that value gets trapped. We focus in on it early in the process so that we have a lot of time during our investment horizon to systematically put in place the building blocks to create value in the company, to be able to scale, and ultimately to be able to realize value in the organization itself.
So it sounds like the family business side of things is kind of built into your DNA. And I'm really looking forward to diving into the kind of the challenges that they face and how you're able to kind of support that scaling process. But just kind of looking back at the economic landscape of Africa, could you tell us a bit about why family businesses are deemed so crucial for the economic landscape of Africa? And how does Sinari contribute to their growth and their sustainability? I know you've touched on this a little bit, but yes, keen to hear more.
I think one of the challenges that the African landscape has had since it became a target for private equity investment for the last several decades has really been that the number of very large companies able to sustain traditional private equity investment models has been relatively small. So the number of large businesses that is in Africa is actually larger than most people think, but relative to its potential and relative to its peer regions, it actually has far less of these large businesses, and it has even the large businesses are, relatively speaking, smaller businesses. What this means is that when private equity first came in force to the broader African market, and in this case, I'm not talking specifically about South Africa. South Africa is a very mature private equity market. In fact, it is 40 years ago this year that the first management buyout was concluded in South Africa by my predecessor firm, Ethos Private Equity. And that really speaks to the fact that it's a very mature market from a private equity transacting perspective. The rest of the continent, it came much later than that. And when it came, there was a wall of capital that came to the continent and not enough opportunities to absorb the capital at that time, particularly if you were looking for controlled transactions. So, not enough sizable opportunities to tap into, and too much capital meant a lot of overpriced transactions that then didn't fulfill the potential or didn't rise up to meet the growth expectations that were priced in, and that resulted in some disappointing returns. So from a private equity investor perspective, I think it's very important to understand that we need to have a broader market that we can play a institutional capital role in, and where we can tap into growth and value unlock, and not just rely on the small number of more mature, or not necessarily mature. In fact, a lot of the businesses I'm about to talk about are exceptionally mature and have been around for generations, but they are a small pocket of traditional accessible private equity transactions. And then there is the vast, vast majority of your medium size, mid-market and large companies across the continent, which comprise of tightly held businesses, right? So a lot of them are family owned. A lot of them are founder run and owner managed. And for today's podcast, I think we're focusing primarily on the family owned businesses. But I think that the application is there across the board, in that a lot of these businesses, family owned businesses, owner managed businesses, do not have a desire to sell control of their business, which means that to be successful, private equity investors have to be able to make do and actually still deliver value addition to these portfolio companies, even not having a controlling stake. Now, this worked really well for us because, again, like I said, when I was leaving leaving Ethos and starting Sonari, the idea was to say, you know, what's the investment angle? And one of the things that we focus in on is reducing key man dependence as the more important driver of value than having control. And that's because if you don't reduce key man dependence, then it doesn't matter whether you have control or not, because the business will not be able to scale beyond the capabilities and capacity of the founder. And ultimately, control still rests, even though it's operational control, but it can still rest within these single individuals or a single family. So in order to play successfully in the African market, it's very important for private equity investors to be able to have an investment focus and strategy that accounts for these tightly held companies, and to understand that these tightly held companies are the significant drivers of job creation and economic growth. In 50% of the GDP across the continent is really derived from your medium-sized and smaller businesses that are predominantly tightly held. So the impact of investing in this space cannot be underestimated. And so we do believe it is critical to support these organizations in their growth and their sustainability. And I really do think that, you know, particularly these companies that are sitting with about 50 to about 200 employees, the data suggests that these businesses create jobs at double the pace of both the large and small business segments. So again, in this mid-market space that is predominantly family-owned businesses or owner-managed businesses, there's a huge need to help these businesses to achieve scale and continue to make an impact.
Thanks, Samantha. So that's really interesting, especially what you were saying about a time where there was all of this capital flowing into the continent. And it sounds like the kind of smaller businesses weren't prepared at that time and weren't ready to scale. And it almost had a detrimental effect. So when we're looking at the kind of size of businesses, could you provide some insights into the characteristics of the size of businesses that Sonari typically invests in? And how do you identify businesses at the inflection point? So when these businesses are ready to scale and contribute further to their growth?
Our particular focus area, you know, within this founder-run, owner-managed, family-owned businesses is very much in businesses that have already achieved a fairly significant amount of scale. So we're looking at businesses that are, you know, our sweet spot would be with, you know, $10 to $50 million in revenues, sometimes larger, sometimes smaller. We can go as low as a business with earning about $3 million in annual revenues. Generally, that is only as part of a series or the beginning of a series of acquisitions or follow-on investments where we expect the company to scale into our sweet spot very quickly. So what it means is the business has already achieved a meaningful amount of scale and is very well established. But, and this is the big but, there is a new avenue for growth, right? So we look for companies that are, like you say, at an inflection point. And these new areas of growth can be things like expanding into new markets, product line extensions. It can be in response to, and this is a very key one for Sonari, in response to both the opportunity and the threat that you find in coming out of the changing technological landscape. In particular, the growing impact of generative AI, And we also look at businesses that are seeking new phases of growth, sometimes just because of generational change. So we've actually invested in businesses where the driver of growth was actually the transition to the second generation, the CEO who took over and was driven to take the business that his father had established to that next phase and realized that he needed both capital, but also an active partner to travel the journey with. So we look for these inflection points. It can be driven by a couple of different elements, but the key here is that the business is about to go through substantial change, and that's really Scenario's value add. Change is hard, and change is where we as a team thrive. We help with change management, both on the strategic or business model side, the technology side, the business model change that has to happen on in some of these instances, but also we help with the people centric side of it. So the change management of the people. So how did we get into this? I actually started off in an unusual place for a private equity practitioner. I started off in psychology. I then rebelled, went into corporate finance, fell in love with corporate finance, and thought I was done with this people stuff, because people stuff is hard, which it is, and number stuff is much easier. But of course, fast forward 20 years, and what we really do is people stuff. And it is the ability to help leadership in these companies to navigate this change, and we help them to navigate it based on our experience, having done this in several different companies, and the model that we've codified, our Scenario 3S, which then translates into our 20-point plan. But it's really around helping these leaders to navigate through change, and bringing in our technology experience as well. Although we're not a technology fund, every one of our senior professionals has got between 12 and 35 years of technology-related experience. Mm-hmm. So in this very rapidly changing environment, we're able to bring perspective and experience and be a thought partner to the leaders of these companies that we're investing in.
Thank you. And I've been really looking forward to asking the next question, because I think it's something that we've kind of touched on throughout this whole podcast so far. And I know that you've mentioned that the skills and perhaps human capital that founders and entrepreneurs needed to get their business to a certain point might not be the skills and human capital or the resources that they need to scale their business to the next stage. So family businesses often grapple with scaling challenges. So how does Scenario facilitate and support the scaling process for these enterprises, especially in the context of the African market?
Okay, so there's obviously, it's obviously case by case. So when we go into a new investment, we spend a lot of time in the beginning trying to understand what is relevant. So there are specific areas that we'll focus in on immediately and do effectively a health check. And that'll be on your human capability and human capital depth. It'll be in areas around your financial function, your governance and compliance. All the kinds of things that make sure that before we start to rapidly scale and grow, we need a very solid foundation. And that's why the first S is really where we start. And sometimes it takes a bit of time before we even start to see the growth coming through in the company, because we're very deliberate around making sure that the foundation is solid before we grow. Because if you've got a mess and you try to scale a mess, we can only imagine that the consequences are not pretty. So we really do focus in, and again, it's very case specific, because some companies really are you know, running a very tight shop in terms of, let's say, their financial function before we come in. And so obviously in that instance, it's not a key focus area. But if the company doesn't have all of its financial function at a really a gold standard, it's something that we will want to work on with them before moving to the next phase. So lay the foundation for your growth is number one. And then we start to look at the capability of the organization to scale. And you're absolutely right. One of the biggest challenges is that the skills and often the people who are employed in the company when we come in, and this is a really tough conversation to have. It's one of the least pleasant aspects of our job, is to have a very brutal conversation around who in the organization is capable of scaling in line with the growth strategy. So if it's a lifestyle business, and you know, which we don't invest in, but if a family business chooses to have a lifestyle business and they're comfortable with that, then it's fine to have an organization structure and your skills in the organization that can really just keep the business going. But in reality, for any of these companies that are seeking to scale at a rapid pace and to really be able to respond to the opportunities and threats that the market is presenting at the moment, there has to be an acknowledgement that oftentimes your existing management or staff skills will not be able to get you to that next level. And so, of course, then it's a question of, so what do you do about it? And that is something that we work with these companies on. But it is about understanding that in some cases, and I would say that anecdotally, we've seen that only about 50% of management teams is really capable of the of generating and sustaining the level of complexity to take the company to that next level. So you've got to deal with kind of the legacy that's coming in. How do you, and particularly for family businesses, how do you secure the legacy, but also enrich the legacy? So you want to take your legacy, all the history that you've built over the years, all the people who've been part of it, but you want to take it into the future. Not taking it into the future could actually mean much more dire consequences for your organization, but it requires overall a commitment to actually making certain changes to take your business forward. I will tell you, it's interesting that, you know, one of the things that's important is how do you build in the family values? And this is something that actually came up in one of our portfolio companies where the CEO was getting to a point where he was about to lose control in the sense of shareholding. He was about to go below the 50% threshold. And he had a really strong gut reaction against this, basically saying, how can I know? So I might be comfortable today with Sanari as a partner, but one day Sanari will exit, because as a private equity firm, we do have to exit at some point. And how do I know that whoever's going to come into place in Sanari, into Sanari's place, is going to share the same values, and in, for example, protecting jobs. In some cases, this company had family members be part of building their company from the very beginning. And how do we protect those jobs? How do we protect those families who've been part of this organization? And my response was, build it into the culture of the company. So it shouldn't be about the values only of the shareholders as individuals, or the values of the family members, but how do you translate that and, again, codify, institutionalize those values into the company, so that anyone who comes in afterwards is going to have to understand the culture of the company and buy into the culture of the company in order to take it forward. So these are all the things that we think about with these companies and these family-owned businesses that are really going through significant changes.
Thanks, Samantha. I think that kind of flows nicely into our next question. So when we're talking about values, my next question will be on option value for businesses. One key aspect of Scenario's approach is creating that option value for businesses. And I feel like this is something that you might have just touched on, but could you elaborate on the conversations and some of the strategies employed by Scenario and the Scenario team to bring a family-owned business to a level where it is exit ready?
So it's a great question because, you know, private equity is not well regarded when it comes to these exit conversations. So we come into a company, there's private equity, or we're speaking to a founder management team, and we're talking about partnering, we're talking about building a relationship, we're talking about going on a journey together. We're effectively talking about marriage, but then suddenly we're also talking about divorce. And suddenly we're talking about exit, and these poor, you know, founders are sitting there wondering how it is that this is the same person who's going to, you know, travel a journey with me in this partnership, but then is also going to, in 5 to 7 years' time, sell me to my closest, fiercest, most hated competitor, because that's the value maximization outcome, right? So basically, this is where we need to have honest conversations, and we need to have these honest conversations with these management teams before we get into the transaction. It doesn't help to have these conversations afterwards. So the kind of conversation that we have with our investee management before we invest is really around, where do we want to go with this business, right? So we acknowledge that as Scenario, we will need to exit at some point, but they may not choose to exit at that point in time. So first of all, it's around having discussions around what does the end game look like, if you wish. The end game in terms of our partnership, the you know, with 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, what does it look like? Are there companies that you do not want to exit to? Let's have those discussions up front. Let's understand that we need to price and we need to account for that really up front. But really, in our three S's, the most important S is the third S, saleable. And it's not, and it's deliberately saleable, not sold. And that is because what we are trying to do is together work with these companies to build the value into the company, to create, as you mentioned, this option value, so that in 5, 7, 10 years' time, all of the shareholders in the business will have a choice of what they would like to do with the organization next, because the value has been built into the organization. The company itself is realizable, even if they do not choose to realize their investment holding at that point in time. So we do have to work with the end in mind, figure out where we want to be at the end of our investment horizon, at the end of our season of investment. And then we work back to where we are today, and we say, what does an organization need to do to put things in place so that by the time we get to that point, there is true, authentic equity value built into the organization, which really then gives management as well as the shareholders a whole lot more option in terms of the way that we go forward. And that's really the discussion that needs to be had up front.
So do you believe that the kind of these trends and these opportunities and challenges that the businesses that you work with face might be similar to other regions across the globe? Or do you think that they are kind of specific to the continent? Or do you think these are, yeah, global opportunities, global trends, global challenges?
Right. So I think it's a bit of both. You know, I think that first of all, as many of us do know, Africa is not one region. It is not one country. It is a amalgamation of very many, very different countries. And so the regional interventions and the regional opportunities do differ in Africa as compared to, for example, if you looked at the Chinese market as one homogenous market or other regions that perhaps have less distinction and can be treated as a more homogenous base. And so there are very distinct opportunities and challenges in each country across the African market. So there is that. The other thing that is perhaps different is that Africa has received attention as an investment destination more recently than many of these other regions. So we are later to the party, but I do think that the party is going to be on this continent. So I think that all of the long-term trends indicate that the growth and opportunity really sits in the African continent, and that does make us unique as well. But where we are similar from a global perspective and the trends, the challenges, etc., and I think that this speaks to, again, this growing complexity that we have to navigate, we do operate in a ever more complex and much more rapidly changing global environment. So the pace of change, so we know that change is the only constant, but the pace of change has changed radically and will continue to change radically. And this is driven largely by your technological trends. So, you know, when you look at the rate of human knowledge growth, and the pace at which that is growing, that is a global phenomenon. And this creates, in some ways, a level playing field. It enables the African market to catch up in terms of development in certain instances. I can also say that the African market has been brilliant in actually establishing a lot of technological responses to challenges in our local market, which are fit for purpose in the African market, but then can actually be applied in other regions. And where because of the extent of some of our challenges, we're actually able to outpace and lead the way in certain technological developments. And certainly in the financial services and telecommunication space and certain areas of technology, we really are seeing that that example. So there's a huge amount of opportunity. I mean, I'll mention, you know, for example, in one of our portfolio companies that does identity verification, because they are solving a problem in an African context, their biometric verifications and biometric identification, what has happened and become a global challenge in this space is that the AI models, the algorithms, don't recognize black and brown faces to the same degree as it recognizes European faces. And as a consequence, there's been elements of bias as well as an inability to incorporate technologies in a way that is inclusive. So because our company has invested in the local African market with a much greater database of black and brown faces, our algorithm is trained in a different way. This technology is then leverageable across the globe. So definitely both answers is really the answer. We are in a global competition, so we need to respond to this increasing complexity in the same way that other regions will have to respond as well. But also we've got unique opportunities and unique challenges, and many of our challenges in the African market actually leads to greater opportunity. So I think it's a very exciting time to be in business on the African continent, and a very exciting and probably a little bit scary time for family-owned businesses on the continent, because the status quo is not necessarily going to be the way to secure your legacy. And that is where it's important that private equity plays a role that helps these businesses to transition and capitalize on these opportunities, but at the same time seeks to secure and preserve the legacy of these extraordinary multi-generational family businesses.
Thank you. I think that was such a great note to end on. I loved what you said about that you think that the party is going to be on the continent, because that's kind of what we believe too, and that's our kind of mission to make that happen. And I'm really interested to hear more about what you were saying about the kind of facial recognition technology and things like that, because it's, yeah, I've heard so much about it kind of in the news. So thank you for that. And thank you for your insights throughout the podcast. It's been very interesting. And it's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Pasha. Very interesting for me as well. And really appreciate the work that AVCA is doing on the continent and in growing our industry and bringing a spotlight to the African private equity opportunity.
Thank you. And thank you to our listeners as well. If you would like to learn more about Sonari Capital, I'm going to pop a link to their website in the description so you can go and check out everything else that they're doing and working on. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode, feel free to explore our entire podcast, and I will see you there.